This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
To kick off our scientific presentations, what I thought I'd do is provide some definitions for resilience, but from my perspective as a geroscientist. And then provide some examples of the sorts of research we are undertaking at the Stein Institute that is focused on resilience. So let's go ahead and get started. So in general, I think there are at least three domains of resilience that are associated with healthy aging. So the first domain refers to one's ability to resist the negative consequences of advancing age. Now, the Stein has made really led pioneering research focus on the things that go right with aging, but we also acknowledge that there are also some negative consequences that we would like to avoid, including increased risk for age-related diseases and conditions. And these are the things that we want to be more resilient to, we want to be more resistant to. The second domain of resilience refers to our ability to adapt to the changes that happen with advancing age. So for example, how well can we adapt to changes in our physical abilities as we grow older? So I'm gonna give an example of this. So I'm an avid surfer, but a couple of years ago started realizing, wow, I'm having a hard time keeping up with these college kids over at Scripps. So what do? I need to adapt. So I went to our craft center, check out their booth, they're on the second floor, and I made a bigger, beefier surfboard. And I've been catching more waves since then, and it's been a lot of fun. I also made the board safety orange colored so that when people see me, they know to get out of the way. So the third domain of resilience that we're gonna hear more about today refers to our ability to recover. So healthy aging isn't just about avoiding sickness, isn't just about avoiding stress. That's not really a reasonable goal. Healthy aging also refers to and is defined by our ability to bounce back. We're gonna hear about this more from Dr. Whitson later. We're gonna encounter these physiological stressors. So we wanna really support your ability to bounce back when this happens. So one of the goals of my laboratory is to try to understand the underlying mechanisms that drive human resilience. So we refer to this as your biological resilience. So human evolution has resulted in a whole network of strategies that support your ability to recover, that support your ability to return to a state of homeostasis after physiological stress. These biological resilience mechanisms exist across biological scales. So there are mechanisms of resilience that deal with the activity of specific molecules. There are mechanisms of resilience that refer to the activities of cells or even tissues. There are also mechanisms that are related to the activities of whole organisms. So these organisms you commonly find in the campus of UC San Diego, these are graduate students. From my observations, my scientific observations, they seem to be ocean-dwelling creatures. But when they're on land, they spend a lot of time working in research labs. And if you want to meet some graduate students today, I encourage you to take a look at our poster sessions. Okay, so this has been introduced, but at our last symposium, I told you about a new initiative supported by Wellcome Leap that we call DRIVE, the Dynamic Resilience Initiative. So the overarching goal of DRIVE is to uncover the biological underpinnings of what we're calling universal resilience. So are there common mechanisms that exist at the intersection of this Venn diagram that can support all of these domains of resilience? So this is something that we've been working on a lot over the past few years, and I'm happy to give you some updates. So why is this important? You know, I think understanding the mechanisms of resilience is really the critical first step for developing interventions that will improve resilience. So by improving resilience, we believe that this will support disease prevention, better recovery, but also better outcomes. So imagine if there was a way to improve your resilience before you go in for that hip replacement or for that knee replacement, or if you can improve your resilience before you go in for that cancer treatment. These are the things that can improve better outcomes, that can support better outcomes. Okay, so how are we doing this? So in the DRIVE study, this is the example I'm going to give you, one of our first focuses was to focus on this ability to resist. This is what we often refer to as life course resilience. Now, an effective way to study resilience across a life course is to look retrospectively. Let's look back and see what happened. So we partnered with the Rancho Bernardo study. This is a longitudinal cohort study, prospective cohort study that was started in 1972 by Dr. Barrett Connor. And since enrolling 8,000 residents of Rancho Bernardo, almost 80% of the people that live there, they've been following these individuals since then and looking at various health outcomes. So as with any population, there's going to be a diversity in outcomes. So what's plotted here are what are called trajectory scores. And these are trajectory scores over 20 years for cognitive function, sensory function, physical function, and the accumulation of comorbidities. So let's not get too caught up in what these graphs look like, but you'll notice that there is a diversity. So there's people who are more resilient, people that are less resilient. I want to show you how we calculate these trajectory scores. And to do that, let's focus on cognitive function. So this is an example of a cognitive test that was administered to Rancho Bernardo participants about every 4 years. This is called a TRAILS test. And what it evaluates is cognitive flexibility, executive control, working memory, visual search, and also motor control. So I'm not going to go through and try to define each of these for you, but instead, let's do one of these tests together. Okay? All right. So to do this test, we asked the participant to place their pencil on the number one where it says begin. So you can point to that if you want to. All right, and then we're going to then move sequentially, but switching between numbers and letters.
Oh boy.
So from one, you go to A, and from A to two, and then from two, you go to not three, to B, and from B to three, and then four, no, C, yes, and so on. And so forth. So, okay. So it's not pass fail. It's not, you know, that hard to. What we're measuring is the time it takes for you to complete this. Right? So we're looking at the time it takes to complete this. So one of our scientists, Nikki Bergstrom, has been looking at scores on this test over time. And what she found was that on average, a participant in the Rancho Bernardo study, from the age of 55 to 85, it takes them longer and longer, progressively longer and longer to complete this task. This is perfectly normal. So these are average representative individuals. However, there were also participants in the Rancho Bernardo study who showed no decline in the time it took to complete this test. So we call these folks our exceptional resilience folks. Now, what Nikki did that's really brilliant is then she looked at blood samples that were collected over these 30 years, and she looked at over 5,000 molecules and the abundance of these molecules in the bloods of these individuals. And what she found was that for these average individuals, there are some molecules that their abundance in your blood, in their blood, goes down progressively with age. However, there are also some molecules, and these are the molecules in these exceptional resilience folks, that have a completely opposite trajectory, actually increasing in abundance. This is really fascinating. So there's some inkling of a biological underpinning to differences between these folks. What's also exciting is that it's not just one molecule. We saw this pattern in a number of molecules. So again, this is how we're starting to understand, you know, what are the underpinnings of resilience. Okay, so what would the next question be? What do these molecules do? All right, so around the same time, this is Anton. So he is one of these graduate students I was talking about earlier. You can check out his poster later. Really started going after the question, what do these molecules do? So what he started doing is taking these blood samples collected over time and start treating cells with these samples and cells in culture and tried to see, okay, what happens to these cells treated with this panel of molecules. And what he found is that, and this is still very preliminary, these seem to improve mitochondrial function. So people familiar with mitochondria, yes, often referred to as the powerhouse of the cell. So these are subcellular organelles, and they're responsible for generating a molecule called ATP. And this molecule is the chemical currency of cellular energy. So 90% of the oxygen we take in as we're sitting here breathing is consumed to help metabolize nutrients from the food that we eat, specifically carbohydrates, for example. And this is then what fuels the generation of this molecule, ATP. So we literally eat and breathe for our mitochondria. So based on these results, we posit that the ability to generate sufficient cellular energy in the form of this molecule ATP is fundamental to biological resilience. Now we're beginning to understand more and more about the mechanisms of resilience. Okay, so when your lab comes to you with really exciting findings such as this, what do you say? You say, cool, let's do it again. So that's what we're doing. We're doing it again. But this time, we're going to focus on our ability to recover. So this is what we call sometimes referred to as dynamic resilience, your ability to bounce back. So this is work that is ongoing, and you're going to meet Dr. Ted Chan later today. And he's the chair of the emergency department who we're partnering with in the conduct of this project. So as Allison mentioned, we are now looking at individuals who end up in the GED, the geriatrics emergency room, due to a fall-related injury. So UC San Diego is fortunate to have California's first Gold Star accredited geriatrics emergency department. It's a fantastic place. So what happens after the GED? So last year, there were over 26,000 visits to the geriatrics emergency department. Over 3,000 of these were due to fall-related injuries, and you'll see the breakdown between men and women in different age groups. But what we're seeing is that 90 days after that GED visit, 24% were back in the ED. So it's really important for us to understand why some people are falling and falling again, and what is helping people bounce back. Now, these are just people who return to that same GED. When we actually ask people who were enrolled in our studies, did you fall again? This number is actually closer to 33% is what we're seeing. Okay, so we're hoped to be done with this project in about a year. And maybe by that time, we'll have a better understanding of what lies at this intersection between life course resilience and dynamic resilience. So stay tuned. For the next part of my presentation, I'd like to talk about some of the work that we're doing that's helping to usher in a new era, I'd say, in healthy aging, resilience, and longevity research that's focused on identifying evidence-based interventions. And we're happy to be doing some of this work at the Stein Institute. You're going to hear from Dr. Newman from the Buck Institute, where they're doing similar sorts of work over there. So it's a really exciting time to be doing this. Now, we realize that there have been very important lessons learned about the factors underlying healthy longevity. And a lot of this evidence comes from observational studies, epidemiological studies, some from preclinical studies, so studies with animals, or small proof of concept studies. So what the field is really trying to do is trying to develop evidence-based interventions that are supported by rigorous clinical trials. So imagine that if you could apply the same clinical trial designs that are typically used to evaluate interventions for disease. So you think about randomized, placebo-controlled, double-blinded trials. Well, we're applying these same sorts of designs now to evaluate interventions for things that can promote resilience and healthy longevity. So we've got a lot of work to do, because over the years, there are a lot of really promising interventions for resilience and healthy longevity. Some of the most promising interventions have been behavioral. So we know exercise is good for you. We also know that sleep plays an important role in resilience and longevity. There's also good evidence for dietary and nutritional interventions. We know that the Mediterranean diet is very good for you. If you want to learn more about whole food plant-based diets, check out some of the presentations we have on UCTV. Really good evidence for the benefits of those as well. Now, some of the things we're starting to evaluate more are, you know, what are the effects of vitamins, minerals, and supplements? How many people are taking multivitamins or supplements? Yeah, virtually everyone. This is really popular. So we need to figure out what really works, right? And then there's also a growing interest in pharmacological interventions. This is not something that we do in our group, but people are thinking about how can we repurpose drugs that are FDA approved to see if they can also promote healthy longevity and resilience. Okay, now, an important thing to consider is it's unlikely that any single intervention is going to work for everyone, right? So I think it's important for us to look across the board and really, as a field, rigorously evaluate what works and what doesn't. Okay, so how do we actually do this? How do you evaluate the effectiveness of an intervention that's to promote resilience and healthy longevity? And how do you do this so that the trial doesn't take decades to complete? Like, we don't want answers in 30 to 40 years. We want answers in a much shorter time period. So what we're doing is we're applying what are called molecular biomarkers of biological age. I think a lot of us are familiar with the notion that our biological age can be different from our chronological age. And your biological age is more related to your risk for developing age-related diseases and conditions. So these are being seen as predictive biomarkers as well. So I told you about the ways we measure mitochondrial function. We have a way to profile an individual's mitochondrial bioenergetic capacity. Our studies also look at other molecular biomarkers of biological age. Each of these would be a separate presentation. So I'm just going to list them here, but happy to talk about them outside. We're looking at epigenome, metabolome, proteome, microbiome, and a lot of this is work we're doing with collaborators at UC San Diego. Now, what's important is to not just look at these molecular biomarkers, but to combine them with measures of function. So when we think about function in healthy aging, we have to think about function across multiple domains. So we measure physical function, cognitive function, sensory function, even mental well-being, because all of these contribute to functional independence and quality of life as we age. Okay, so if you participate in one of our studies, I'm just going to show some of the sorts of things that you might experience as a participant enrolled in one of our trials. So to measure physical performance, we have a whole battery of assessments that we do, including assessments of gait speed, leg strength, and grip strength. I've tried all of these things myself, so I wouldn't ask you to do anything I wouldn't do myself. So look at cardiorespiratory fitness. This is something we do quite often. This is cardiopulmonary exercise testing, where we measure VO2 max. And this is an excellent indicator of your fitness. We prioritize safety in all of these studies, and we prioritize that all of these assessments are age and ability appropriate. We also do something called the physical performance battery, where we look at your balance, your gait, your ability to stand up out of a chair. I'm going to start going through these a little bit more quickly. We look at actigraphy to measure how much you're moving throughout the day. We look at body composition. We use a measurement called DEXA, dual X-ray absorptiometry. That's hard to say. But with the DEXA machine, it tells you about your bone mineral density and also body composition. We look also at muscle composition, the size, and adiposity using ultrasounds. We looked at cognitive performance using these sorts of tests that are sometimes done on paper, like the TRAILS test I showed you earlier, but some of these tests are also done on iPads. We look at your sensory abilities, again, across multiple domains. And then we look at mental well-being as well, because this is really important. It matters to you. So we prioritize looking at all of these domains. So here's an example of a study that we completed in our living lab. where we looked at both the molecular markers and the functional markers. And you're going to hear about from Dr. Moran, I believe, later today. And he's the one that led the study. And this was done in our living lab. The study is called Strong Foundations. It's a falls prevention study aimed at building balance, strength, and improving posture. And what we found was that after 12 weeks of completion of this program, this resulted in improvements in strength and balance. But on the molecular level, we also saw improvements in mitochondrial function. So again, putting together the molecular and the functional. Okay, so I'm going to wrap up. But I wanted just to introduce some of the new research studies that we have just launched or are about to launch, and we'll be seeking volunteers. I don't suggest you volunteer for the GED study. We'd rather you don't fall and end up in the emergency room. But if you do, we'd be happy to have you join our study. One of these is a study called MIMIC. MIMIC stands for multivitamin and mineral supplementation impacting cellular metabolism, so impacting mitochondria. This is Dr. Lena Skandalis. If you'd like to learn more about the MIMIC study, you'll see her outside. You can check it out in the registration booth. What's really exciting about MIMIC is for this study, we've partnered with Haleon. I don't know if you're familiar with Haleon, but these are the folks that make Centrum. They actually make a lot of the products you see at CVS and Walgreens, from Advil to Sensodyne, and so on and so forth. So we're really thrilled to be partnering with the industry leaders to provide evidence-based data on what works and what doesn't. Dr. Moore mentioned the XPRI study. We'll share more information about this soon. We're submitting the protocol, and you'll be able to learn more about how to pull a volunteer for the study soon. This is a smaller proof of concept study. Now, if you don't qualify for any of the ongoing studies, just please sign up to our newsletter. We'll have new studies starting all the time. So with that, I'd just like to acknowledge the members of my team, our funding sources, and also support from the Stein family and the Lim family. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.